Introduce our main speaker, Craig C. from Las Vegas.
This is Al, our sound man. He's getting everything ready for us. This is beautiful. Thank you, sir. Hi, everybody. Craig Clove, alcoholic. Sobriety date is September 28th, 1985. That wasn't my idea. It just happened. Welcome to the people that are new. I'm really glad you're here. And if you're not glad you're here, that even makes us happier you're here, because you'll probably do okay. I don't think anybody that I know that's sober any length of time or has anything I want was initially happy to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like the worst place I could possibly end up. They frown on drinking there, and that really kind of, like Kelsey was talking about, that's kind of like, I like doing that, and tried some a little bit after I showed up here originally. Welcome to the visitors, and congratulations to all the people that took birthdays tonight. That's really a big deal. I also want to thank the group for inviting me to come here. I don't know about this, you know, major expense deal, but I was interested in the part where it says there's unique expenses such as lodging, so I don't know if Billy and I are getting a room tonight or what. I was listening to when Dane took his cake and all the people cheering and that whole, I'm like, that is awesome. That is awesome that there's that kind of enthusiasm here. And that's the thing that attracted me to Alcoholics Anonymous, was the people in AA that were enthusiastic about being in AA. Now, initially, what I try to do is not like those kind of people, because I know I don't have a chance of hell of being like those people. So, you know, whenever you can see somebody that has what you want, you know you can never have it, hate them for it, right? And that was kind of my... But these guys were down around that old Thai club when I ended up in Samaritan House, and they were sober and happy. I've been sober, I've been happy, but I've never been sober and happy. And these guys were sober and happy, and happiness is one of those things I've never been able to fake. I can fake a lot of things, but that's not one of them. And man, I was dying to have what they had. You know, they looked like the guys that had been, you know, through college together and played football together and, you know, just done, grew up together, that whole thing. And man, I knew I could never be like that. And I wanted so bad to be like them. And I didn't know, you know, how do you approach... I mean, I live in Samaritan House. What I'm saying is I'm homeless, is what I'm saying. And I don't have any... That's the only place I got to go, except the meetings at the Thai club. And I shuffle up to the Thai club and pretend I'm glad to be there. And you can tell I'm not. And these guys seem to be real exclusive. They seem to me to be better than the rest and have their nose in the air. And those terrible feelings of separation between me and them, I'm not like them. And those, I didn't know this, but those feelings came from inside of me. They never put that out. And so when I don't even know how we ended up in conversations, to tell you the truth. I don't remember the day I decided, you know, I think I'll go talk to these people. It just happened. The conversations happened, and I started showing up and, excuse me, going to coffee and doing things like that with them, meeting them at meetings. They were big on going to meetings, and it was better than the meetings in Samaritan House. I didn't like the meetings in Samaritan. I didn't like any meetings, to tell you the truth. I didn't even like Samaritan House, to tell you the truth. I really didn't. I remember my little trek over to Samaritan House after I left Detox for the second time. And Detox wasn't next door then. It was over on wherever it was, Martin Luther King and Alta. And I remember getting out of there, and they were sending me to Samaritan House. I heard some other guys when I was there 6 or 7 weeks earlier talking about Samaritan House. That's got kind of a nice ring to it. Samaritan House, that sounds friendly. You know, I'll go to Samaritan House. Well, when you get over in front of it and you look at it, you think, whew, is that it, you know? This ain't exactly what I had in mind. Anyway, I couldn't bear going in that day. To save a long story, I had been in detox and got out and drank the next day and was shocked. Shocked. I was in detox 8 days. I mean, how much recovery can you stand in your life, but 8 days in a row of solid recovery? And drink the next day. So 6 or 7 weeks later, when my brother made me call him back, all I could say is, hey, your thing didn't work. You know, I need to come back. And they just come back and stay the night on the mats, and a guy gets sick on me. He's in a seizure. Long story short, I go to Samaritan House the next morning, and I couldn't take it. I couldn't bear going in. It was a Wednesday morning, September 25th. I couldn't take it. I looked at that place. I saw what was going in and out of Samaritan House and thought, my God, look at that. What would people think of me if I was in Samaritan House? So I went across the street to the park and leaned up against one of those old elm trees and apparently dozed off, trying to come up with a plan. And the alarm clock went off. Actually, the sprinklers came on, and it was much like an alarm clock. And I scrambled it off the lawn. I mean, it was just a humiliating moment. I mean, people drive by on the short bus, look at the nitwit getting soaked, you know. And it was terrible. They talk about a turning point here, and I assure you that that was one of the moments in my life that I was the most broken to me. And I go over there, and I'm soaking wet, and I go squishing up to the... And I stand in front of that long sidewalk up to the door of Samaritan House, and you know, up the sidewalk I go, and I get in there, and a little guy standing there, he looked like a big guy that night and that morning. He just, you know, his name was Dewey Bell. He looked like he was 9'12" and mean, nasty, bad attitude, grumpy, glasses, you know, black hair, the whole thing. And he said, what's your problem, kid? And I meant to say, well, Dewey, I need a $2,000 loan and a towel, but what fell out of my mouth was, I can't quit drinking and I need some help. And he you can sleep on the couch. The couch? Exposed to all the other men in this house? That's not a safe place for Butterball to sleep, you know what I mean? Anyway. Whatever, I thought. You know, I go in there and I go on the couch, and they're making me go to meetings. And you know what? One of his rules was, you drink one drink and you are gone. I'll roll you up. That's what he said, and a few other little words. And okay, you can trust me. I will not drink. And I didn't. Till Friday, because Friday was you got 10 days to get a job. Now, this is Thursday morning, Wednesday morning, I'm there in Samaritan House. You got 10 days to get a job, and I'm thinking, well, good Lord, when are we going to recover? But they're not joking. You got 10 days, and then you're gone. And I mean, it's almost like I might as well pack now. It's not going to work out for me. I mean, I just know that. And on Thursday, I just kind of wandered around and didn't really do much. I went over to where my dad and my brother were working, and I couldn't be around there, but just long enough that the dispatcher there said, hey, I told Glenn about you. Glenn was an old friend. I was just a little kid growing up with these guys, and he said Glenn got hurt, and they rehabilitated him and taught him how to refinish furniture. He said you could come over there and he'd give you a little money to help you get you on your feet. And I thought, sounds like a plan. So I go over to Glenn's shop, and I hadn't seen him and Betty for a long time. And, we kind of say our howdy do's. And at the time, I'm like 175 pounds. And that might seem like a lot to you, but I'm 315 right now. And I mean, I was real thin and kind of like not, and you know, I had this big afro thing going on and you know, I'm happening. And he said, what do you want? What do you got? What do you got? He said, well, you can go back here and you can help strip these chairs and whatnot. And I, you know, I get back there and I can tell AA's already working and God's will is starting to come true because there's a little blonde girl back there and I'm thinking, oh boy, that's what I need. I've been sober for 2 days. It's time for love. And I swear to God. But I got to watch how I approach this. And I'm kind of chit-chatting. And I'm trying to make small talk. And I mean, I'm not the most elegant kind. You know, I'm just a cluster, fill in the blank. And I'm back there and I'm trying to act enthusiastic about doing this. I don't want to be there. I don't want to be there. And I'm hoping she gets the idea. She doesn't want to be there and she'd rather be with me and we'll go on and live our... But it didn't work out. Anyway, I said to her, we're just chit-chatting, and she says to me, so would you like a wine cooler? This was the question of questions. Would you like a wine cooler? I'm stumped for an answer. Now, this is spinning through my head in about 2 seconds. I thought to myself, well, if I say, yeah, Dewey Bell said, you're out of here. One drink and you're out of here, and I don't want to blow my sobriety. I'm working hard on recovery right now. And I'm thinking, you know, she's going to say, oh, what, you don't want to drink? Why, don't you drink? No, I'm in recovery. Well, how long have you been in recovery, Craig? Day and a half. And, you know, it's just kind of going to hell on me. And so I said, yes, I would like a wine cooler. And so I drank that wine cooler. Now, I can't run home to Samaritan House and tell Dewey Bell I had a wine cooler because that grumpy old... He's going to roll, so I just kind of pretend like it didn't happen for 19 years. And one night I was telling Bob D, I don't know, he's a goofball, and just before my 20th birthday, and a long story short, that's when it changed to the 28th. Because, oh, by the way, I'm not living in Samaritan House now, so I can tell I'm not going to get kicked out. And... Actually, I was living alone by then. I wasn't going to kick myself out of my own house for drinking. And that's that story. I didn't think I was going to like Alcoholics Anonymous. I really didn't. And I know the morning that I walked in Samaritan House, if you'd have stopped me walking up that sidewalk and you'd have said, yeah, how you doing? I'd have told you, terrible. I'm doing terrible. This is absolutely the worst freaking day of my entire life. Never have I experienced anything so humiliating or degrading that would drive, look where I'm going. Do you still need to ask me how I'm doing? But if you ask me about that today, I'll tell you, that was a great day in Craig's life, because that's the day my life changed, and I didn't know it. That's the day my life, something inside of me was broken. The thing that I suppose stopped me all my life kind of was broke that day, and that was my own self-reliance. And I started going in there and following directions. I became willing to follow directions, and I did a lot of things that I, on a good day, would never do. No, I'm not going to pray. No, I'm not going to ask for help. No, I'm not going to that meeting. No, I'm not going to go get, I ain't going to do nothing. And I was interested to hear Kelsey talk about her, just how that correlates to the level of pain as to how much I'm going to do. And that's my experience. In fact, when I was in, I thought about it tonight. You remind me of a little gal that was in that detox with me. She was a cute little thing like you. And about the time, she was about 15. And she was a little bitch is what she turned out to be. She did. You know, I was one of those guys in detox, and I hear you all talk about these kind of guys all the time. The I know guys, you know, no matter what it is, well, Craig, you know what? Look, you're all screwed up. You got to, yeah, I know. And what that basically means is shut up. I don't want to hear it anymore. You know, you see them in detox and jail all the time. I know. And I'm one of those I know guys. And I'm also one of the one-up guys. Every time you have a problem, you know, you hurt one person, I hurt two, you hurt three, I hurt five, whatever the story is. And I'm in detox, and the truth is I'm just pathetic is what I am. I never did anything. I always wanted to be a badass, but I'm way too pathetic for that. Anyway, I'm in this detox, and this everybody in this, it was nice because they'd have the group sessions, you know, and you group, and you get to hear how screwed up everybody talks about, how screwed up they are. And I'm agreeing with, oh, yes, you are screwed up. But listen, Ernie, you know what I, you know, and I'm just like that all day long. And in this one meeting, I remember the gal's name was Karen, and she was talking about something she was terribly ashamed of. She was ashamed that she left her one child and left her and abandoned her. And here I come. Oh, don't worry, Karen. Every time somebody said something, I got a comment. Oh, don't worry about it, Karen. You left one child. I left three. You know, this big drama thing. And this little gal stands up. Her name, I think, was Michelle, so not to worry. I know it wasn't you, Kelsey. Stands up and looks over my direction and says, she was swearing is what she was doing. And what is wrong? Why are you here? What is wrong with you? Well, I wondered who she was talking to. She's looking right at me. Oh, and then she proceeded to give me a ass chewing. I mean, it just went on and on and on. And I thought, you know, you have 5 minutes, Missy. And, you know, it just on. And I started feeling embarrassed for her. And I started thinking, God, you know, these people are going to, boy, are you going to get yours when you shut your little mouth? These people are going to turn and tell you the what's over and how good of a job I'm doing. And they gave her a standing ovation. And I don't like detox anymore. Time for me to go. And I was stuck there a couple more days. It was terrible. It was a horrible experience. They were full of ungratefuls. And I was just trying to, I don't know what I was trying to do. I'm so full of delusion. Anyway, I started going to those meetings. And I didn't want to go to meetings, but there was nothing left. That seems like such a terrible place when you say there's nothing left. When a doctor's diagnosing a patient and said, you know what, there's nothing left that we can do. It's pretty drastic. And that's the position I got to, where there was nothing left. I got no more wiggle room, and I got to start taking action that I don't, you know, at the time I'm not even going to argue, but on a good day I'm going to, I don't need this, I don't need that, blah, 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 blah. And I just started doing it. And I'll tell you, my life changed. And it changed big time. And it's not like that I healed up and just got good real quick, or even at all. It's a matter that I got just a little taste, and then, okay, let's not over-recover here. And, you know, that's enough. And I always said that if I'd have drank like I do Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't be alcoholic, because I do just enough till I feel it and say, no more for me, I'm starting to feel it. That's enough. I feel good. And sober more than 10 years. Undrunk, let's not say sober. Let's say haven't had a drink in over 10 years. Everything that I thought, if I had this stuff, I'd be there. You know? That's why I have this compulsion to manage my life. Not because I think I'm a great manager. I just have an overwhelming desire to be there. And there is not here. I don't want to be here. I want to be there. And you see things that think, when I stopped drinking used to get me there. So my great obsession after not drinking anymore becomes finding a way to get back there. I want to be there again. And it looks to me like if I had her, I'd be there. And then maybe you get her and realize, well, wait a minute. If I had her, I got her. We're not there yet, but if I had that car, we could drive there in it. You know what I mean? I got this hole inside of me, and I don't know nothing about this spiritual malady that people call alcoholism. I don't know anything about, I don't even think I got alcoholism. But that's another story another day. But what I got in me is there's this emptiness. And you take a girl, it feels, bam, I'll stick her in that hole and it'll be great. And then you just, A couple of weeks, months, whatever, later, I noticed a little outer rim right around the outside of her that says it's not quite enough yet. And so I find that truck and I shove that in there and it fills it for a minute, and then I need, you know, it needs tires or an oil change, and it's not quite in a house, and boom, and a job, and boom, and all this stuff, and boom, and if I had my kids back, I'd be there, and if I went to that meeting, I'd be, and I just keep shoving that in, and I'm not there. Where I end up is in a place that I've managed my life into such a mess that everything I thought that if I had all that, I'd be there and be happy. That's where there really is anyway. It's just that feeling that life is good. People talk about, it talks about that in our book, that drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. You know, joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. And that's all I want to do is have that feeling that life is good. And I get all that stuff and I wished I was dead. I wished I was dead. There's nothing wrong with any of that stuff. There's nothing wrong with any of that. It's all good stuff. But the problem is it's not an effective treatment for this spiritual illness called alcoholism that I seem to suffer from. You know, and I'm trying to stuff all this thing in that hole and make me better, and I'm just getting worse and worse and worse and sicker and sicker and sicker until finally I cross some lines that I said I would never cross. That's what I always do, is cross lines I said I would never cross. It's almost as if it's a challenge. I'll never cross this line, but I'll push right up to the edge and hang out there as long as I can. And I crossed some lines. She said if I ever did, she'd call the police, and I believed her. And when she yelled up the stairs at our little girl that said, "Katie, I'm calling the cops, we're moving out," I thought, she's right. And I got my shotgun in the garage, and you know, hell, by this time we'd been in marriage counseling for a few years, and I'm in meetings every day. And I think I'm in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think I'm in right, I'm dead center in AA. There's not a possibility that this is alcoholism. What could you be suffering from? And I'm going to a counselor who wants to help me, and he's asking me questions. He's saying, "Do you have a sponsor?" He knows it's wino. He knows all about wino. He knows we go to a lot of meetings. He knows I talk to him every day. Every day. I don't tell him I don't take the steps. I just kind of, he don't need to know all that. That's just too personal. You know what I mean? I don't tell him anything. I leave him with the illusion that this is a real one here. I've got a real one here. I've got one of those real guys that's doing everything he can to recover from alcoholism. It ain't working, and I got what he needs to help him. Now, I'm not here to pick a fight with anybody about anything, because what you do is your thing. This is just what happened to me. This guy really cared about me. I'd been seeing him for a couple of years, my wife and I, and he, whatever happened one night, we couldn't make it, and then he couldn't make it for a couple of weeks. So it'd been a month or so since we'd seen him, and we get in there one night, and he's just upset. And I don't know what I've done. I know it's about me. I know I've done something. And I'm spinning in my head, and he's like, he's just upset. I know something's bad wrong. You can tell. Kids over there, mom and dad in here, and we go in the office, and he's sitting at his desk and shuffling through papers, and he's, you know, like this, and I'm thinking, oh, geez, what's going on here? And he said, he looks up, and he's got these big tears coming down his face, and he said, "You know, you and Karen have become more than clients, you've become very close friends." And I think, oh my God, I know what the deal is. I know what he is. He's fallen in love with Karen. They're going to run off and have an affair. I know what it is. I deserve that. I know that's what's going on. And he goes on to say, "You know, particularly I've gotten close to Craig." And I thought, ooh, it's worse than I thought. And this is a true story. And he's crying, and he says, "I can't see you for 3 or 4 months. Do you want to know why?" "Yeah." He says, "I'm going to check into Betty Ford to get off the medicine I was going to prescribe to him." There was a little voice inside of me that went, damn it, just about when I'm going to get help. You know what I mean? And there was another little voice that just, another little voice that went, oh, I didn't know anything about that stuff. That day, it was a while later that this incident I was describing up there at that house happened. When I had that shotgun loaded, and I knew when the police came to the door, I'll take a couple of shots over their head, they'll shoot me, and that's how I'm going to get out. Can't take an overdose of pills, because what if it doesn't work? You know what I mean? And you just walk around trying to talk to people, and you're not able to communicate anymore effectively. You can't shoot yourself, because what if it doesn't work? You know, and you blow half your face off, and then go to meetings for the next 35 years, and people call on you to share, and you grunt for half an hour, and everybody pretends to be grateful they heard from you. You know what I mean? I've thought those kind of things. Besides, if you take an overdose of pills, then they say, well, he didn't die sober. You know, if you take a gunshot from a cop, well, at least he died sober, damn it. And there's some sort of a da-da in that. And what happens is Keith Thomas shows up at the front door. You know, and you're huffing and puffing and ready to blow the house down, and there's Keith Thomas at the door. What's going on? I'm busy. Get out of here. And so he ruined my life is what he did. I end up with that damn, we go for a ride, and he's trying to work his AA stuff on me. And he did. He was a good AA that night. Whenever I think about my judgments of other people and you know what they do or how they appear to me and how Keith and I's relationship has been for more than 20 years, I think about that night, and I think about a story that Peggy Martin told one time at a roundup. I heard her, and she talked about all them starfish that had washed up on the beach, and there's a guy down there, and he's flinging them out there and flinging them out, and there's just millions of them on this beach, and a jogger come running along and said to this guy throwing these starfish back out in the ocean, he said, what are you doing? He said, I'm throwing them back. He said, look at them. It's overwhelming. What difference could it make? And he grabs one and flings it out over the water and says, it made all the difference in the world to that one. And that's exactly what my experience was that night. It made all the difference in the world to me. Might not mean much to you, but I'm telling you, it changed my life. I found the motivation that Kelsey was talking about shortly after that to start doing things that I wouldn't normally do. And I got reacquainted with my old sponsor. And it wasn't, and I committed to doing things, and he just, oh my God, I won't do that. And, well, you said you wouldn't argue. Okay, geez, thanks. I wondered to myself, why do I call this guy? It's never good news, you know. I want to call, and I call, and oh, can you go pick this guy up and give him a ride to the meeting? And I do, and the guy thanks him for me giving, you know, I want to thank Bob for giving me a ride. But wait a minute, that was my car, you know. Anyway, I'm telling you, I've had fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. If this thing wasn't fun, nobody'd be here. I'm going to tell you that for a fact. It's not that we don't go through some hard times, but if this thing wasn't a great deal of joy in this, I'm not going to be here. Most of the people I know aren't going to be here. And I started following direction. I started taking direction that I hadn't taken before. I committed to doing an inventory, and the guy trapped me and took me to California, and we do this stupid inventory and get back. And I'll tell you, one of my great fears was, I was afraid he was going to get that Jaguar to up to about 120 and say, okay, bozo, I'm going to get even with you now. Get out. And that was a real fear. I mean, I was petrified. And I kept asking him, you want me to drive? And, you know, and that never came true. And I mean, he and I got very close. And he helped me tremendously through the divorce from our ex-wife. You know, we have that whole story. And I mean, it was unbelievable. He showed me what a member of Alcoholics Anonymous does. I heard a guy named Scott Shields say one time, in relation to a guy that was dating his ex or whatever, he said, "You know what, if you want to drink, that's your business. If you want to stop, it's mine. You know, it's mine." And he said he'd stick his hand out to this guy, and I thought, boy, that's some big stuff. I don't know if I could do that. You know, I got to mention, my little buddy Billy Smith's back here tonight, and I'm glad he's here. He and I used to go clowning around out in the hills quite a bit and chasing around, pretending to hunt. We were just driving around BSing is what we're doing, talking about how bad each other was. But he had this little dog. I called it the rodent because that's what it looked like. Anyway, he had to put that little dog down this morning. And I know how tough that is. And I'm glad he's here. And when I heard people in Alcoholics Anonymous talking about things like this when I was early on in AA, I thought, that's no place in AA about that stupid stuff. The thing that's amazing to me is the friendships and the history that develops here with people. You know, when I see Keith all the time now, and Keith and Sue, and I remember him from when I was a real newcomer, and how he, I don't remember what he said. Sorry, I don't remember what he said. I really don't. But I remember how he treated me and what a difference that made. That's what I remember so famously about Wade Bergen and Mark Perkins and all them guys in Happy Jack and all, is not what they said. I don't remember a damn thing they said, but I remember how I felt when they were around. I remember they would do things like they would remember my name, and how, boom, I just, you know, that was incredible. So I try to do that. I'm not very good at it. Everybody's, "Hey, man, hey, pal, what's going on?" And that just means I don't remember your name. And my secret's out. And, you know, I started a career, and I just thought I wanted to be this deal around the convention center. I remember talking to my sponsor when I was really new, and he said, "Oh, if you just keep working like this, you can do anything you want." I can do anything I want. And it just seemed like crap to me. But I'll tell you what, it kind of came to pass. And I don't know when it was now, a year or so ago, actually it was a couple of years ago, that I kind of made plans to not retire, but resign. I didn't really have a future plan. I just had I'm going to resign. What are you going to do after that? Wait a minute, I'll get back to you. But I didn't get that far. It was like, well, I'm going to resign. I'm going to get a real estate license, and I'm going to give it a shot. And I did that. And I'm still doing that. And the funny thing is, it just got to the point, Miss Billy kept telling me, "You need a part-time job, you need a part-time job." Because, oh, by the way, in my late 40s, I decide to quit my job that I've been in for 20 years, start a new career I know absolutely nothing about, get married, and buy a new house. Kind of in that order. And somebody said, "Boy, you sure about that?" And I thought, well, you know, I trust God. Yeah, either that or you're an idiot. And, you know, a few times. I don't know. I can't explain it. It's working out. I cannot explain it. It's the damnedest thing. You know, people in AA were trying to ruin AA with this God business. And I thought it was all festering down at that Thai club on that Sunday morning meeting. I thought if we could get rid of that, then we'd save AA, because they're ruining it with God and God and God and God. And I'm going to get away from God. God ain't done nothing for me. You know, and somebody asked me one day, "What have you done for him? What have you done for him?" And I don't like those kind of questions. And I remember, I'm not going to do anything for him. You do something for me, and if it's spectacular enough, hey, you know, I'll give you a ride to a meeting. And you can give credit to whoever you want. And I didn't know about God. I was very afraid of God. Now, nobody in my childhood ever told me that God was bad. I don't know where, it's my idea. I picked it up somewhere. I don't know where it come from. It wasn't church. I don't know where it come from. It's like a lot of things that I know. I don't know where they come from either, but I know that they're the way that it is. You know, and that little prayer that we say in places around town that set aside everything I think I know about you, God, everything I think I know about me. Help me set aside everything I think I know about others and everything I think I know about my own recovery. Also, I may have a new experience in you, a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, and a much needed new experience in my own recovery. Because I'll tell you what, no matter who it is here tonight, if you don't change, you'll drink again. If I don't change, I'll drink again. The guy I am right now will drink again if he don't change. That's just the way that it is. And I've come to understand that about me and my life. But this God thing, just I was terrified of it. And the reason I like that little prayer so much is it does help me express what I'm trying to get to. My goal. Help me set aside everything I think I know about you, because my fear makes me think I know a lot, you know, and about this new experience. You know, when I got married, Billy has a little boy. His name is Dean. He was 9 when we got married, and there's a bunch of little 9-year-olds in our neighborhood, a bunch of little 9-year-olds. And, you know, I kind of went on a thing tonight that made me think about it. I went up this friend of mine from work, her and her mother got into this lease deal that's, it wasn't making sense. And so I go with them to the guy's place that leased him he wanted to know who I was and what I was, and then he asked me to leave. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, if you're going to stay, sit down. Put your hands on the table. And it was awkward and my feelings were hurt, and you know, can't you tell I'm friendly? And I put my hands on the table, and at the end he said, you know what, I apologize for that. He said, I really thought you were here to cause trouble. Well, I thought, well, I've heard that before, you know. And it made me think of this little thing with Dean. I mean, when those little neighborhood boys used to come over to the house, they'd walk real softly when they'd see me sitting in that chair. They'd walk in and they'd look at me and they'd just kind of veer away and around. And it really kind of epitomizes my relationship with God that I developed through watching your relationship with God. You know, I am way too afraid of God and have way too many of my own ideas to be able to set them aside. But what I watched you do is have a relationship with God. And I watched how you and your God interacted. And much like these little boys watched me and little Dean interact. And they would see him come home from school and jump up in my lap and sit. And I would hug him for a while and kiss him. And then he'd go off and play and go do his things. And you know, there's not one of those kids that's afraid to walk in my house today. Just walk in the pantry, help themselves, get something, go upstairs. They just walk in. And I thought, man, you know what? That's from them watching me and Dean have this relationship. And that's exactly my relationship with God, watching you and God have this relationship. You know, I've learned to trust this power. I've learned to count on this power. I've learned that this power isn't, after all, out to get me. Maybe he is out to get me. Maybe he's out to get us, but not in the way I thought. Maybe he's not out to get me. Maybe he's out to get me. Come on. I love having them boys over at the house and hearing the little noise and the chatter and the playing and the Halloween and just all that stuff. I'm into it. I'm into it. And I'm into Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the enthusiasm from over here tonight when Dane was taking that cake and I watched the guys over at Rich's house and how they're all pitching in, and you just sort of throw them in the pond and there's people in and out of there and it's all over, and people here are in service and helping them. You got to go this meeting and that meeting. I thought to myself, how in the hell am I going to have time to work? There's too many places to go and meetings I want to go to and people to see. And it's incredible. Incredible. I didn't know that a life like this was available to somebody like me. I did not know. All my sponsor ever told me to do was to ask God. He said, you got to ask God. Whenever I would approach, and it wasn't even just him, it was them with a problem, the answer was, well, ask God. And I thought what that meant is, well, you don't know what the answer is what that means. And now you're trying to blame God. Oh, well, ask God, because the truth is we don't know. And the truth is you didn't know, but you did know to have me to ask God. And I believe this power has influenced and affected my life, has come into my life. The thing that I didn't understand about the steps, I thought the steps were the magic, and actually I guess they kind of are, but what the steps have done is remove me out of the way enough for God to reveal himself to me. And the first times that I was asking God to, and I said it just like that, God, will you please reveal yourself to me? Man, I'll tell you, at first it was like seeing a guy in a third grade schoolyard with, you know, a trench coat, you know, reveal. It just felt awkward. I was like, oh God, no, I don't want to see that, you know. But that isn't what it is. That isn't been what it is. You know, my fears are the things that block me. I'm one of those people who fear blocks them a lot. And I remember when I was a little boy, we spent a lot of time in the summers, all my brothers and I, up in southern Utah, where my mom still lives. And we had horses and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know, for whatever reason, I wasn't up there at that time. I'd come up a few days later. And I remember my brothers telling me that this little saddle shed we had burnt down. That's where we kept all kinds of stuff in there, guns and everything else. And it all burnt down, and I'm, wow. And they said, well, it was like 2:00 in the morning that this thing happened, and it was a volunteer fire department and all that stuff. And I said, I'm just a little kid. I don't know too much. And they said the real trouble was trying to get the horses back. I'm thinking, get the horses back? Why the horses? I mean, it's a big old corral. They could just, it's all, Grandpa went running down there and made us let the horses out. Why did you make them let the horses out, Grandpa? He said, well, those horses get so afraid they're going to get burned, they'll actually run right into the fire. And I thought to myself, that is a stupid animal is what that is, you know? When I started taking inventory and in the fear inventory, you know what I mean? Not only have I run into the fire, I'm usually the guy that sets the fire and then runs into it. And then comes to you and say, I can't believe I got burned. Let me tell you how it happened. It wasn't me. It was them. And, you don't buy it. No, 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 no. Anytime there's something wrong with you, there's something wrong with you, bud. It ain't them. It ain't her. It's her. No, it ain't her. It better be her. It ain't her. It's you. That's impossible. That's impossible. Do some inventory. You find out it's true. I'll be damned, it was me. It always was me. When I started trying to make amends to my family, because for so long I was so separated from them. And I don't mean separated physically. Hell, I work with them. But that emotional separation, I can feel them judging me. I know what they think of me. You know, I never paid him back. And my little buddy Rich always said, pay him back. You want to be spiritual? Pay the money. And I'm thinking, I don't want to be spiritual that bad, you know. I want to be a little spiritual. Can we just talk about this? And I start trying to pay the money back. And a funny thing happened. The relationship with my older brother that I had that was always real strained since we were little kids isn't real strained anymore. In fact, we're always really glad to see each other. I know when I made the amend for some money I took when we were just little kids, he said to me, he said, Craig, we were just kids. Yeah, I know, and it's almost killed me. I'll be damned. Isn't that funny? Just kid stuff. But enough that it was almost, you know, it's tossed. And I know my mom called me a day or two later and said, your brother called, and he was funny. I said, the kid's okay? And I, yeah, it ain't none of that. He was just, my brother's like a rock with eyes. And that's what we say at work. And, him and my dad were the best of friends. And at my dad's funeral, he never broke once. He may have cried by himself later, but he was solid, rock solid at that funeral. And mom told me, she said, you know, Daryl told me what you did the other day. And I said, oh, yeah, I know. I felt terrible. It was just embarrassing. She said, oh, it meant a lot to him. I said, how do you know? She said, he was crying. These amends don't work. This stuff isn't real. You know what I mean? I know when I, and the last thing I'll end with is that my relationship with my mother, who is in not too good a shape right now. You know, she's getting old and the time's coming. Anyway, I was always very distant when I would go up there. When I was married to my second wife, Karen, she used to tell me all the time, when we go to Utah, I hate going to Utah with you because you're different when we're up there. There's something wrong with you. This, and she said, we get back here and it takes a while. You don't just snap back. We go through the gorge. We go into the gorge one way and you come out another way. I don't know who you are. And when we come back, you don't just change back all of a sudden. It takes a while. She said, you are mean and you are nasty and you're uncommunicative and you're shut down. And I thought, well, I can tell you some things about you that you don't know too, Missy. But I, you know when you're beat. And so I'm telling Bob one time, we're leaving this meeting or something, and I'm telling him, I said, you know, Bob, I said, I really wish I would have got even with my dad before he died. You know, because I'd heard another one of these great amends stories. And me and my dad lived together for the next 3,700 years, and we were just happier than pigs in the mud. And just enough to make you sick. And especially if that's not your experience with your dad. I stood at my dad's funeral knowing I owed him over $10,000 and never made one payment. He raised my kids. I paid minimal child support. He raised my three kids. I don't know what... And I came down here to live happy, joyous, and free. You know what I mean? I get sobered up and I don't go take care of my kids and take care of my responsibilities or pay my dad back or square up or nothing else. You know what I do? Look at my new truck. Look at my new house. Look at my new this. Look at my new that. Look at my new gun. Look at my new clothes. I mean, just whatever. They never seem to be too happy about that stuff. And anyway, going to this meeting and leaving with Bob, and I said, I wish I'd have made amends to my dad and I paid him that money back. And I'm waiting for a discussion like, oh, Craig, that's too bad. I like people to still feel sorry for me. Oh, Craig, that's too bad. I really wish you would have too, but it doesn't, so it sucks and you're just going to have to live with it. But he doesn't say that. What pops out of his mouth was, well, you could pay your mom. You're breaking up, but we were walking together, and I mean, I don't know what to say. I'm stunned. I swear, it stuns me. I could pay my mom? He looked at me, and he said, yeah, you could pay your mom. He said, your mom and dad were always married, weren't they? Yeah. So any debt that he left, she acquired. Yeah. Pay my mom back. What the hell? So we started talking about the amount, and he said, you know what? He said, the amount. He said, I know you're going to want to pay, you know, this grandiose amount. Yeah, here's your 10 grand. Leave me alone. And he said, that ain't the way it's going to go. He said, you make an amount that you can pay every month. He said, if you can pay a little more, that's fine, but don't ever pay less. Don't ever pay less. He said, because the amends are about you being different. I'm not the same guy I was. You were always full of, I'll give you $500 next week, let me have 20. But let's just see if you can pay this. So we came up with this amount, and I was very consistent with that for a long time. And when I decided I wanted to get married and I wanted to buy this house and start a new life, kind of, I had to talk to my mom and tell her what I was doing. And I said, and she said, don't worry about it. She says, you know what's funny? She said, I've come to count on that money. And she said, you have no idea. I mean, just in little different things over the years, she said, I've really counted on that money. And you know what? I got so used to paying it, I didn't even notice it was gone. And the funny thing was, before I knew it, the amount had been paid even more. And I didn't know. I was looking in some old check registers the other day at how much. And you know, when I'm up to the $95 and $9,600 marks, I'm thinking, wow, I didn't know I'd paid that much back. Those were old. Those were a year before I, you know, told her, hey, Mom, I, you know, with this new house and everything, she said, your debt's paid. So when me and Miss Billy went up to see her and probably say goodbye to her the other day, I was able to sit there and say, if there's anything that you need, she said, I know, it's fine. She said, I would like some pictures. So we ran over to the house and got some pictures of the grandkids and whatnot to give her. And, you know, that was a tremendous thing for me. Because I thought, you know, on the day that my mom dies, I don't want to be standing in that funeral home or wherever we're at, feeling that separation that I felt like I did when my dad died. When my dad died, it was freaking horrible. I got those kids looking at me, and are you going to take care of me now? And, I, you know, just this whole mess. I mean, a whole mess. And I'm at the place now, because of the steps, God, you, and Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm at a place now that I can actually participate in this thing with my brothers as a part of, not separate from. And that all came through starting to make those amends and pay back the money and do these tedious little things that seem like crap and they don't make any difference. They've made all the difference in the world. Like that little starfish, you know, when that guy threw it back, it's made all the difference in the world to this one. You might not make the difference to everybody, but you sure as hell have to me. Thanks.